Well, thank you. We appreciate the panelists yesterday who kicked this discussion off with some very good information for all of us to think about. Appreciate the staff's briefing paper that also had a lot of good information in it that gave the opportunity for good dialogue at the breakout sessions. There was no lack of enthusiasm in the breakout sessions in terms of sharing views and ideas. And I think we've got some very good information here on how we should proceed in at the Office of the Chief Auditor in coming up with recommendations to the board in these areas. So a very, very important topic. And thank you for your input. And Arnold, I acknowledge that you've got a similar project, and we'll stay in close touch as to what you're doing at the IAASB also. Thank you. The next item on the agenda is an update from me. So during the next 45 minutes or so, we'll turn to an overview of our standard-setting activities, both recently issued standards or other types of guidance, and a review of standard-setting projects that are on our agenda. During this session, we're also particularly interested in hearing from you regarding current developments or emerging issues that you think might bear on our standard-setting activities. As you recall, yesterday I mentioned two items that some of the SAG members brought up that they thought we should discuss and that I will bring up as part of an emerging issues discussion. But if there are any other matters that come to your attention that you think should be on our agenda or you think should be discussed today as part of emerging issues that I don't cover, please, please bring them up. Also, during the next 45 minutes, don't think of this as a soliloquy. Please raise your tent card at any time during the presentation to try to make a point in connection with what I'm saying at that point in time. So don't feel that you have to wait to the end. There's a couple of documents that are in front of you that I'll be making reference to. I want to bring them to your attention. The first one is a document called PCAOB Issued Standard Setting Proposals and Guidance, October 2009 to April 2010. That, if you will, is standards or guidance that we've issued since the last SAG meeting in October or over the last 6 months. The second document that I'll be making reference to, also in front of you, is called Standing Advisory Group Meeting, OCA Current Standard Setting Agenda, April 7th, 8th, 2010. So those are the two documents I'll be making reference to. The first document I'll comment on is the standards and proposals and guidance that we've issued since the last SAG meeting, October through April 2010. First is risk assessment standards. On December 17th, 2009, we reproposed seven new auditing standards. We refer to these seven standards collectively as the risk assessment standards. But in reality, they range from planning and supervising the audit to identifying and responding to the risks of material misstatement in the audit to evaluating audit results and gathering audit evidence. The proposed risk assessment standards build upon and improve the audit framework in existing PCAOB standards. Some of the other very important elements of these standards include some of the following matters. Alignment with auditing standard number 5, an audit of internal control over financial reporting integrated with the audit of the financial statements. In drafting the reproposed risk assessment standards, in response to comments, we've carefully considered the requirements of AS5 and audits of financial statements and closely linked the concepts of identifying and assessing and responding to risk in audits of financial statements with integrated audits over controls of financial reporting and financial statements. Consideration of fraud. The proposed standards emphasize the auditor's responsibilities for considering the risk of fraud throughout the audit, incorporating requirements into these standards from AU 316, consideration of fraud in a financial statement audit, makes clear that the auditor's responsibility for considering the risk of fraud is an integral part of the audit process rather than a separate, isolated process, as has sometimes been noted by the board's inspections process. So we think the risk assessment standards do a good job of requiring that fraud considerations go on throughout the entire audit process. With respect to auditing disclosures, based on observations from the board's oversight activities, we believe that improvements can be made by auditors and their approach to testing and evaluating disclosures. The proposed standards contain new requirements regarding the auditor's responsibility for evaluating disclosures. The comment period for these proposed standards ended on March 2nd, and later this morning, Keith Wilson, who leads this project, will present an overview of the comments received and our steps going forward. The second document on this paper deals with engagement quality review. AS7 engagement quality review was approved by the SEC in January and is effective for all interim reviews and audits beginning after December 15, 2009. In its order approving AS7, the SEC urged the PCAOB to consider issuing further staff guidance regarding the documentation requirements of AS7 in light of numerous questions they received regarding an example that was in the release accompanying the standard. So in February, we issued a staff Q&A regarding the documentation requirements. In summary, the documentation standard for an engagement quality review is a rigorous one, but is largely a principle-based one. The documentation of an EQR, quote, should contain sufficient information to enable an experienced auditor having no previous connection to the audit to understand the nature and extent of procedures performed by the reviewer to comply with the provisions of the standard. We believe that the staff Q&A clarified the responsibilities, and conversations with the profession, we understand from them that they think so as well. With respect to communications with audit committee, on March 29th, the board proposed a new standard on communications with audit committee to supersede the existing standards AU 310, the appointment of the independent auditor, and AU 380, communications with the audit committees. At last October's SAG meeting, we had extensive discussions with this group, and SAG members expressed significant support for proposing a new standard and increasing the requirements. In doing so, the members also wanted to make sure that we didn't chill the communication environment that existed between auditors and audit committees. And one of the key aspects of that was to continue to permit communications to be made orally and not require them all to be in writing. In doing that, one of the additional requirements that we added was that oral communications must be documented by the auditor as part of the working papers. A fundamental objective of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act is to strengthen the role of the audit committee by placing the audit committee rather than management at the intersection between the company and the auditor. The objective can only be realized, however, if there is meaningful and robust dialogue between the auditor and the audit committee. Accordingly, the proposed standard expands and clarifies the requirements that govern auditor communications with the audit committee. Some of the examples in the proposed auditing standard are as follows. First, the proposal addresses establishing an understanding through an engagement letter between the auditor and the audit committee regarding the services to be performed. This better aligns the board standards with the requirements of the Act. Second, the auditor would be required to communicate with the audit committee regarding audit strategy and discuss significant risks that the auditor identified during the planning and risk assessment phases of the audit. The goal here is to make the audit committee oversight more effective by arming the committee with upfront information regarding the auditor's view of the risks and how they will be addressed. This also presents the opportunity for the audit committee to share their view of other risks that the auditor may not see in the same light that the audit committee does. Third, the proposal would clarify and expand required communications regarding the auditor's perspective on the critical accounting policies and practices and the company's critical accounting estimates. These topics are particularly relevant in light of the additional attention that the economic crisis has brought to management's judgments and estimates, particularly related to fair value and other estimates. Fourth, the auditor would be required to provide insights and evaluations regarding the quality, clarity, and completeness of the company's financial statements, including related disclosures. These matters go to the heart of both the auditor's and the audit committee's responsibilities. And finally, the auditor would be required to evaluate whether the two-way communications between the auditor and the audit committee has been adequate to support the objectives of the audit. In October, many of the SAG members emphasized the importance of the two-way communications and asked us to consider ways to promote those two-way communications as part of a proposed new standard. So the proposed new standard includes many other new requirements, and I believe this standard should serve to improve audit quality and further investor protection. Comments on the proposed standard are due by May 28, 2010. Next item deals with Practice Alert 5, which we issued just yesterday, entitled Auditor Considerations Regarding Significant Unusual Transactions. During the course of an audit, the auditor may become aware of significant transactions that are outside the normal course of business for the company or that otherwise appear to be unusual given the auditor's understanding of the company and its environment. Significant unusual transactions, especially those close to period end that pose difficult substance over form questions, can provide opportunities for companies to engage in fraudulent financial reporting. The financial statement presentation and disclosure of significant unusual transactions could preclude the financial statements from being fairly presented in conformity with the applicable financial reporting framework. The auditor should gain an understanding of the business rationale for such transactions and whether that rationale suggests that the transactions may have been entered into to engage in fraudulent financial reporting or conceal a misappropriation of assets. The auditor should determine that the audit committee is informed about the methods used to account for significant unusual transactions. Staff audit practice alert number 3, audit considerations in the current economic environment, was issued in December 2008 to assist auditors in identifying matters related to the current economic environment that might affect audit risk and require additional audit emphasis. Practice alert number 3 reminds auditors that the auditor's response to the risks of material misstatement due to fraud includes evaluating the business rationale for significant unusual transactions. In the staff's view, although the economic conditions have changed since December 2008, the risk factors, including the risks of significant unusual transactions that existed in December 2008, continue to exist today and may affect the risk of material misstatement of the financial statements. The existing standards of the PCAOB contain a variety of requirements related to significant, unusual, or complex transactions, or a combination thereof. The purpose of practice alert number 5 is to complement practice alert number 3 by compiling the relevant requirements from existing PCAOB auditing standards regarding significant unusual transactions into one document, and also to raise the attention of the auditor and the attention auditor's awareness of these transactions as part of their interim reviews and annual audits coming up. I'll pause for a moment if there are any questions with respect to the matters and the standards that we've proposed or the practice really alerts that we've recently issued. If there are none, I'll go on to the next document, which is our standard-setting agenda to discuss items that we're working on and our milestones with respect to when we expect to issue this additional guidance. The standard-setting agenda includes key milestones, proposed issuance dates of concept releases or proposed standards, and proposed adoption dates. In most cases in the agenda, you'll see that there's a possibility for a reproposal period, but that will depend, of course, on comments received. The timetable we propose is also contingent on the board determining during each phase that the staff should continue to pursue a standard-setting project in each of these areas. Finally, emerging issues, new accounting developments, or new legislative initiatives could impact the projected milestones or could result in other priorities not on the agenda. Before I begin this discussion, I'd like to address a question from the last SAG meeting regarding the extent to which the PCAOB inspection process informs our standard-setting agenda. In response to that question at the last meeting, I confirm that the inspections do inform our standard-setting agenda, but I thought I'd build on that a little bit more today. In the release accompanying each of the proposed standards or standards that we issue, we do indicate how inspections have informed that proposal. Beyond that, though, there's a lot more that goes on behind the scenes. The standards group meets with inspections leadership on a regular basis to get their views on our proposed standards. We also meet with inspection team leads and ask them where they think auditing standards need to be improved. The inspections teams are the eyes and ears of the PCAOB, observing audits and observing audit quality, so they can give us great insight as to where standards might need to be improved. For example, inspectors might find a potentially deficient audit, but believe they can't raise the matter as a Part 1 finding because they thought that the auditing standard wasn't as strong as it could be. In those cases, they can make recommendations for us to improve the applicable auditing standard. Another example might be in the responses from the firms to inspection reports. If the firm disagrees with inspection findings, as they sometimes do, we question, is it because the standard can be interpreted in different ways? That is, the inspections team feels strong enough that they feel that they have a finding that is so egregious it belongs in Part 1, that is, that the audit was not performed, taken as a whole, in accordance with PCAOB standards. Yet from time to time, you'll see in the responses from the firms will say they disagree with the finding for one reason or another. We need to understand that and determine, is that because the standards are written in such a way that they could be interpreted differently by our inspectors than by the auditors implementing those standards? If that's the case, then we need to get behind those particular standards and find ways to tighten the requirements so that those disagreements don't exist. So the long answer to the question of whether or not inspections activities informs our standard-setting process is still yes, but I wanted to share with you some of the substance behind that statement. So let me turn to the standard setting agenda. The first item on the agenda is risk assessment. I've already mentioned the 7 risk assessment standards in my comments, and we'll provide an update on those comments received in a little while. As you can see, though, we are targeting final adoption of the risk assessment standards in the third quarter, with a goal for them to be effective for 2011 audits. Working through the comments received and adopting the standards in final form by the third quarter is ambitious, but we'll work hard to achieve that target, as we believe the implementation of them in connection with 2,000 audits would be an important improvement to audit quality. I've also mentioned the next item on the standard setting agenda, communications with audit committee at some length. Again, the comment period is open on that, and some SAG members, like Denny Beresford mentioned, he's already in the process of writing our comment letter, and we'll look forward to comment letters throughout the process. With respect to the standard setting item on audit confirmations, we've finished analyzing the comments from the concept release and are putting the finishing touches on a proposed standard. We have to finish our discussions with the board, but our office expects that we'll be able to propose this standard during the current quarter. A summary of the comments received on the confirmation concept release was discussed with the SAG last October. Regarding the next item, signing of the audit report, in late 2009, we issued a concept release addressing whether the engagement partner should be required to sign the audit opinion in his or her name in addition to the firm name. I've already commented briefly on this in response to a question raised. We summarized comments with respect to this concept release at the last SAG meeting. This is one of these items where there were very polar responses with very strong views at both ends of the equation. My office is continuing to review this matter, analyzing the comments, looking at developments in other countries, and we expect to make a recommendation to the board in the near term on how we believe the board should proceed. If we proceed with rulemaking and based on the board's decision, a proposal could be issued, in my view, in the third quarter. But again, that depends on our recommendation and the board's views of our recommendation. On the next item, working closely with our Office of General Counsel, we're continuing to consider a release for issuance with respect to the application of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act provision on, quote, failure to supervise. The staff is currently working on a draft release for the board's consideration relating to the board's application of Section 105CA of the Act, which authorizes the board to impose sanctions on registered public accounting firms and their supervisory personnel for failing to supervise the firm's audit practice. Subject to board approval, this release could be issued this quarter as well. The next 3 standard-setting projects on the agenda related parties, specialists, and fair value measurements were the main topics of discussion, including briefing papers, with the SAG at last October's meeting. We're planning to propose standards on these matters in either this quarter or next quarter. There are many important matters to be addressed in connection with these projects. So I'll say, as with all our standard-setting initiatives, we're more focused on getting it right than getting it out on a particular date. But having said that, I believe we're making good progress towards our stated objective with respect to the proposed issuance date. The next project on the agenda pertaining to principal auditor and multi-location audits was, of course, discussed in detail with you yesterday. I believe this is one of the most important areas for further improvements in our audit standards, and so we're aggressively targeting the third quarter for a proposal here. Somewhat related to the principal auditor project is number 10 on the list, quality control standards, including quality controls over the work of affiliated firms. Among other things in this project is consideration of quality controls that exist at the global organization level of network firms and how they relate to the individual quality controls at the quality controls at the individual firm levels. Many of the larger network firms have a global organization that in one way or another provides quality controls throughout the network, but most often that particular organization is not a registered firm with the PCAOB, but we're looking at ways in which we would build into our quality control standards activities that take place throughout the organization. For the next items on the agenda, which are items 11 through 13, we're continuing to address whether to proceed with standard setting on these particular items. The one where we are furthest along with our thinking deals with certain requirements that were adopted from the AICPA's SEC practice section as part of the board's interim standards. These requirements, which now pertain only to registered firms that were part of the SEC practice section at the time the board adopted these standards, are varied and include matters such as Appendix K reviews of U.S. filings audited by foreign audited firms, the review of those filings by the U.S. Firm in the network, independence, quality controls, continuing professional education, and certain other matters. Subject to board approval, we expect to take some action on these items during 2010. With respect to the next item on going concern, I'll ask Peter maybe to comment on this if we didn't set this up in advance, but maybe you'd be willing to make a comment or two on this. The FASB has a project underway with respect to going concern. Going concern responsibilities are largely rest in the auditing literature today, and there are certain requirements with respect to the auditor to assess whether there is substantial doubt about the ability of a company's ability to continue as a going concern. FASB has put going concern as a project on its agenda, and I think there's been some recent discussions at the board, and Peter, maybe you could update us on that.
Yeah, thank you, Marty. This, as you say, this started out as what we thought was a simple exercise to bring into management's responsibility that assessment. And then, of course, we couldn't resist, and so we made some changes to promote convergence with IFRS, specifically relating to the look-forward period, whereas the audit literature seems to strictly look at a 12-month period. IFRS does not limit it to 12 months, and that was the subject of a lot of consternation, and this group discussed it last year. So what the board tried to do was to explain what we really meant by that, and we used some terminology about a reasonable period, a practical period of time where information is available. The other issue that came up through this group was the meaning of substantial doubt as it relates to the ability to pay obligations as they come due. And so the board relooked at that and wanted to try not to create a new trigger for disclosure, but to use something that already existed in our literature. And so we gravitated to FAS 5 that has the three buckets, the remote bucket, the reasonably possible, and the probable bucket. And so we've had a lot of internal discussions about reasonably possible as being the trigger for management to provide disclosures about these issues that they would have to deal with to be able to pay obligations as they come due. Some of us thought that was too low a threshold. It's just above remote, if you will. The board met on that recently, and instead we're trying to describe it as using current facts that would indicate that you may not be able to settle your obligations in the ordinary course of business without selling assets, issuing equity, and we have a list of conditions. What we want to try to do, at least what I hope we do, is provide some color commentary around that, so we try to drive the point home that something that is reasonably foreseeable does not necessarily have to rise to the level of being more likely than not. I think, to be frank, I think, you know, still there's going to be a lot of judgment and gray area in this area. What the board is trying to do is to create an earlier disclosure of these situations that companies may have to deal with. So we're using this notion of reasonably foreseeable, and we're trying to use the concept of reasonable commercial business judgment. That's where we are now. So we're kind of at the point now where we're ready to put a proposal out.
Thanks, Peter, for that update. We're closely coordinating or closely following that that project. Our staff is staying in touch with the FASB staff. We do have audit guidance and auditor responsibility with respect to reporting in the opinion when they think there is substantial doubt about a company's ability to continue as a going concern. But if our guidance is not consistent with new guidance that's coming out of the FASB, we'll have to consider how to address that guidance. So I think SAG members have asked us at the last meeting to stay close to what FASB is doing in this area and consider how it impacts existing PCOB standards with respect to going concern. Kevin O'Reilly?
Yeah, Marty, just along that broad topic, and we touched on this at the orientation meeting a few months back, and that is with all the other changes coming down the track relative to the FASB projects, is there been or should there be a special outreach type program between the PCAOB staff and the FASB staff to, one, make sure the FASB staff is aware of auditing considerations relative to all of these new standards, or conversely, whether the PCAOB staff needs to get ahead of changes in the audit guidance relative to these standards when adopted?
Good point. We have, I consider it to be regular communications with the SEC and the FASB on our collective developments. Just earlier this week, on Monday, we had our formal meeting, a quarterly meeting that we have, which includes senior members from the Office of the Chief Accountant. Jim Croker was up at FASB, and we actually did this part of a video conference as well with folks in Washington. I was up at FASB with Bob Herz and other members and a variety of the SEC and PCOB members here in Washington. We talked about our standard-setting agenda that I just went over here. The board gave an update on their standard-setting agenda. The SEC talked about a variety of matters on their plate, and we all talk about how they all intersect and talk about issues of auditability and things of that nature. So you're right, there's a lot going on, and it's important for us to stay in close touch, and I think we are. Barbara, did you have a further comment that you wanted to make? I think you...
I just pointed out that several of the members of OCA staff also help with external reviews of FASB documents, and we do read them from the perspective of how it could affect auditors, and we provide our feedback both to the Office of the Chief Auditor Accountant at the SEC and to FASB.
Sam Ranzilla?
I guess consistent with this discussion around going concern, what I don't see on your agenda is with respect to contingencies. And as I understand it, the FASB is close to doing something with an expansion of FAS 5 disclosures around contingencies. If you remember, there was an exposure draft that sort of hit with a thud in the fall of 2008 and has been kind of sitting there. As I understand it, the board, the FASB, is close to reissuing something, and depending on what that looks like, I think there are concerns as to what can be audited and what we will be able to get from outside counsel in the form of audit evidence with respect to those disclosures. So, again, a place where I'm hopeful your office is working very closely with the accounting standard setters and, quite frankly, may require some involvement with the likes of the American Bar Association.
You're absolutely right that some of the initial proposal that came out gave us all a lot of concern that there'll be some problems with the existing treaty with the Bar Association and what might have to be done. Peter, is that your card up over there?
Yes. Just in terms of status, the board will be meeting to discuss that topic next week. The staff, what the goal was to deal with the issues that came up through the comment letters, through the roundtables that we had, to try to pull back from imposing a prognostication of an outcome, and to really try to drive earlier disclosure of factual information. At the same time, we're trying to be very careful because there obviously is some prognostication required under existing GAAP, certainly at least to distinguish between probable and anything other than probable. The staff had, in fact, recommended to the board or was planning to recommend to the board that we move to a final standard on the basis that we felt that we adequately addressed the concerns that were raised by all the parties. The board had some concern about that, just because of the sensitivity of this whole area. They seem to be leaning towards re-exposing, but that decision will be made hopefully next week.
Okay, thank you for that update. So I think I would like to reassure those who posed that question that we are staying close, and without a doubt there are a lot of developments going on, especially in the convergence area, and the impact that could have on accounting standards is very important as we consider related auditing standards. Two other items that aren't on this standard setting agenda are the following. One we just discussed, and I think you can be assured that it is on the standard setting agenda going forward, and that is the auditor's report for us to consider changes to the auditor's report in the context of the conversations we just had earlier, both potential changes in the language of the report and whether or not, and the focus groups that we talked about as a potential standard setting matter for the board to consider on the other items that investors have asked for. Another item not on this agenda and could be a very significant undertaking pertains to the audits of non-public broker-dealers. As I think many of you are aware, non-public auditors of non-public broker-dealers now have to register with the PCAOB, but the PCAOB does not have inspection authority or standard-setting authority with respect to those audits. Legislation is currently pending before Congress, which could give the PCAOB inspection and standard-setting authority with respect to those audits. If that legislation is approved, we will have to move promptly to address the audit requirements for broker-dealers and propose appropriate auditing standards that our inspectors can inspect against. With respect to this, we are staying close to this issue. We've had discussions with the SEC, FINRA, and with the audit profession, and we believe this project could be significant both in its scope and its timing. With that, that concludes my comments on standard setting, and I'm happy to take additional comments, questions, before we move to the emerging issues that were discussed. John White.
Marty, staying with the low-hanging fruit theme, we talked a lot yesterday about the principal auditor discussion, and you mentioned that you were very enthusiastic in moving forward with that. When I was kind of thinking about what we talked about yesterday, we really had two things we were talking about. One of them was this, you had raised it, and then Wayne certainly emphasized it. I'll call it the companies with the lots of operations and assets in China. And it seemed to me that there was agreement that that is, I'm just going to say, quite egregious in many ways, and that we have existing enforcement and inspection tools available with respect to enforcing current standards. And if the PCAOB were to move in that direction, I would think that Wayne and the SEC have at the corporation finance and enforcement level have a variety of tools available as well. I would have thought that all of that didn't need to wait until we came out with changes in the standards or proposed changes, which even if you were successful in doing that in the third, getting things proposed in the third quarter is a long time frame and is really different than that part of yesterday's discussion. So I guess I would like to urge both on the enforcement and the inspection side at the PCAOB, and Wayne, urge you to see if you could move forward in that direction. I'll just say separately.
Thank you. Certainly, we are, the board and inspections are aware of these risks, as we talked about yesterday, and I think we have the tools to move ahead appropriately when we find situations that are inappropriate in connection with existing standards. Having said that, of course, this is a project where we believe existing standards can even be further improved. But if we hear you that there's a problem out there, and hopefully we all will be dealing with it. Two emerging issues were addressed, and I mentioned them briefly yesterday. One dealt with estimates, including impairments and allowance for loan losses. And I guess some have noted, or some SAG members have noted, there have been a lot of Part 1 findings from our inspections groups regarding auditors' work with respect to impairment assessments and deficiencies with respect to some of those audits and getting behind the underlying management assumptions and inputs to models and things of that nature for long-lived assets that could be the subject of impairment. Also, we mentioned that in connection with the acquisition of certain banks, failed banks, the FDIC has been taking some large charges, which might indicate that there were assets that hadn't been written down to appropriate values beforehand. So I think both issues are important. With respect to the goodwill, I wonder if that issue is getting behind us to some degree. I do note that a recent survey by Duff and Phelps indicated that out of approximately 6,000 companies, 68% wrote down the value of goodwill in 2008. So I wonder if that's a consideration that indicates that maybe that issue is being tackled. With respect to financial service companies, current loan loss provisions, and other than temporary impairment of securities, may not be keeping pace, or maybe they haven't been keeping pace with the expectations of market participants based upon the actions that the FDIC had to take. These are, I think our practice alert number 3 addressed both of these areas as key areas of audit risk. And I just wonder if there's any further discussion of these items by either the auditors or others at this table with respect to concerns in these areas. One of the questions I might have for you, Peter, is, again, sorry if I keep calling on you, but it was my understanding that to some extent some companies stopped looking at market cap in connection with some of their goodwill analysis and impairment, and instead went to, because of feeling that market cap was not representative any longer, and looked at enterprise value as a concept to compare against the carrying value of their assets, and wondered if that was a subject that the board was had given any thought to of the right way to look at that, and whether going back and forth between the two was acceptable.
I'm a little at disadvantage here. I have not been involved in that issue. Maybe I could get some help from any EITF members. But yeah, that is an issue that I believe is being looked at by the EITF in terms of whether the enterprise value is a better benchmark to use for the evaluation of an impairment. But I'm not sure where that is or that the board members or I should say I don't know if the board members have a strong view on that.
Okay, thank you very much. Damon Silvers?
I just want to repeat a comment I've made at several of these meetings about the issues of long-lived assets in financial institutions. I do not believe, and I'm speaking in the context of my work on the oversight panel for TARP, I do not believe that the financial statements of the major financial institutions that that hold significant amounts of real estate assets are terribly useful to anybody at the moment in trying to determine what the you know, true financial state of those institutions is. I think that has been I think if you review our reports, particularly our toxic asset report from August 2009, it's impossible to review that report and not come away with the conclusion that if 20 people in the employ of the United States Congress cannot figure out the value of toxic assets on the bank books, then there's something wrong with the bank's books and the way they are prepared and audited. This is, I believe, a continuing and ongoing problem. I will give you just one example, which is currently bedeviling both our panel and I think policymakers in general, which is a major problem in dealing with the mortgage foreclosure crisis is the existence of second liens, second mortgages, home equity loans on top of first mortgages. It's proving very difficult to restructure first mortgages in an economically rational way because of the overlay of the second liens. Now, if you think about it for a moment, that would seem to suggest that those second liens probably aren't worth very much. Right? And yet they're being carried on the books of the owners of those liens at, shall we say, closer to full value than would seem to be warranted by the situation I just described. And so I think this is a matter that should be of continuing interest to the board.
Thanks for that input, and I'm sure our inspections folks will find that a valuable input as they think about audits as they look at in the current year. John White. Turner?
Marty, I'd like to just echo what Damon has said. It's my understanding that the banking regulators, in fact, are looking at some of the audits now with some of these failed institutions where they've taken them over. And if we were to find ourselves in a situation similar to what we had with the SNL, it certainly will not build confidence in the auditing profession. So I would hope that the enforcement group here is closely coordinated with the FDIC and others looking at these audits of these institutions, but as you look at what they're reporting as losses when they take them over versus some of these balance sheets, when you look at them, you know, even going back some period of time before the failure, there just seems to be a total disconnect between the two scenarios. And I just don't think that enhances and builds the confidence that we need. So I hope you guys are looking closely at this area.
Thanks, Lynn. Jeff Mahoney?
I'd just like to second that comment. It was recently reported that two banks that the FDIC took over just recently, Advana Corp and also Appalachian Bankshares, Inc., they're the holding companies for these two banks. So based on the FDIC's loss projections, Advana Bank Corp's assets have been overstated by about 85%. And for Appalachian, the FDIC estimates would suggest their assets were overstated by 103%. So I just encourage the PCOB to continue to focus in the banking area in connection with their inspection process. Also noted there was a, maybe you've already reviewed this, but there was a recently issued study in Accounting Horizons on restatements and disclosures related to restatements. And that study concludes that there appears to be some deficiencies in the implementation of SOX internal control, weakness attestation, and reporting requirements. So you might want to take a look at that study and see if there's anything to be learned there. Thank you.
Thanks. We appreciate those insights.